And hopefully this will work. I won't make any big bets on it, but, you know, hope springs eternal. Yes? Yeah, if you want to take your finals early, we much prefer early finals to late finals if you're looking at, and the final is the last day of class, yes. It's not in the regular final exam slot because we know that everybody would really scream at us if we made y'all sit around on campus waiting for one exam to happen, since nobody else uses the exam slots anyway, regardless of what the dean's offices lean on us to do. We listen to students more often than we listen to deans, which is one of the few instances in which this university actually adapts to what students want. That said, so the exam is set for the last day of classes, which is the December 11th. You bring a blue book, blah, 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 the usual stuff. And we will reschedule, but you got to give us some basis other than, you know, I want to get to Cancun before the rush. You know, so come up with an excuse and we'll figure out something to do. Good. Does that do it? Okay. Any other sort of administrative BS kinds of things? Okay, cool. I mean, not BS. Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, more terrorist dragnetting. Yeah, you know, it gets scary. We'll talk about this when we work on records and archives. You know, it's interesting to see that there's now an entrepreneurial space for chasing terrorists, which is really scary. Oh, my business model is to scrape up brown people and put them in jail. Really scary. In any case, we left off talking about open source software. I mentioned, of course, just to catch you, just to get us back in gear on this, that IBM decided a few years back that mainframes no longer had a future, and instead what they would do is become a service company. Now, the way Linux works, Linux is obviously the standard or the basic open source operating system. The way it works is that there are thousands and thousands of people who work on it, all volunteer, all for free. You can download actually some very good Linux packages. Ubuntu is a favorite, Ubuntu. You can download it, load it up on your machine regardless of what platform you're using. Very nice software. And actually, if you want to use Ubuntu in place of Mac OS X or in place of Windows as a consumer, works quite well. But the really interesting thing about Linux is that it's very, very scalable and very, very expandable. So what you can use on your laptop, a corporation can use as a server. And they can run server farms using exactly the same OS with a few modifications. But moving from a consumer level box to an enterprise version is not easy. Imagine yourself, for example, being a, I don't know, dental service provider. You've got all kinds of patient accounts to handle. You've got scheduling to handle. You've got a number of fairly specific, highly detailed tasks you need to do. Now, there is not Linux software out there, for the most part, that's custom designed to run a dental service agency or dental service, whatever they do. And so what you would do is if you're of a sufficient size to be able to afford it, you give IBM a call and say, I'm setting up a dental service bureau and I need a custom application, custom environment to run my entire enterprise, and will you come in and do this? And IBM says, you bet we will. We'll charge you handsomely to do it, but we'll contract to do it. And it's basically a service approach. Interestingly, IBM can deploy these solutions with the software written pretty much anywhere in the world. You know, some of the best Linux programmers are in India right now. And IBM has a huge Linux coding shop in Bangalore. And so if you're a dental service agency, chances are your code might get written somewhere in the Indian subcontinent. Now, another interesting piece of this, and again, I mentioned Yochai Benkler's work the other day. Maybe that was only in section. I can't remember, but okay, I mentioned it in the end of class on Tuesday. And what he points out is that if we start looking closely at the open source model of business, if we can call a not-for-profit volunteer system as a business, it works on a completely different ethic. It works on the ethic that people benefit best and technology is developed best, not by a rival producer-consumer. The producer wants to charge as much as the consumer can afford to pay. Instead of working from that notion of rivalry, that somebody's money comes at somebody else's expense, there's what I might even call an open source ethic that says we can build a new economy off of sharing. We can share content, we can share talent, and our rewards are peer recognition, our rewards are a sense of belonging to a community, whether it's virtual or real doesn't matter. And indeed, this goes back to something I talked about very, very early in the course, and that is information and knowledge exist within social environments. They are sustained by social environments. And indeed, knowledge and information only exist when they are in motion. When they are in motion means that they're moving between people and they're growing and the people are growing with that whole process. So we can take, I would argue, this notion of open source software, and as Benkler does in his book, The Wealth of Networks, we can begin to imagine a new way of organizing an economy based on sharing, based on mutual support rather than mutual rivalry. And one of the first places we're seeing that happening is in open source content. Increasingly, you know, for me as an academic, right, I write a lot of stuff, I published a lot of stuff. Most of what gets published within universities among scholars is published by for-profit publishers. So we end up again in that weird situation where most of the research we do in universities is publicly funded. Most of us don't make any money off of the research that we do. We certainly make virtually no money off the publications, but our sharing of ideas within our various academic disciplines, whether it's information or engineering or humanities, the publications are still largely controlled by private for-profit interests, which is why you have these very expensive journals. So this whole notion of shared ideas, of shared knowledge, that indeed the entire university community globally is built on, is fundamentally violated by the fact of these private publishers being out there engaging in academic publication only because it makes them money. So we've seen, under the Creative Commons model, we've seen the emergence of open source academic content. So we have the Public Library of Science. And under PLOS, Public Library of Science, we have PLOS Biology, PLOS Chemistry, etc. And over the last few years, these have started to emerge, and they're starting to become the leading, the top-end journals in their fields. So we can ask the question, is this open source model going to get a lot of traction? You know, there are a lot of interests on the ground who want to keep academic publication expensive. There are a lot of corporations like Microsoft and Apple which want to keep software knowledge proprietary and for profit. In other words, there's a lot of legacy of old capitalist models that are doing their best to keep this stuff nailed down. One of the ways they keep it nailed down, of course, is lock-in. You know, if you have a Windows or a Mac OS X installation on your machine, switching over to Linux does take some time. Yeah, the software is free, but your time in installing it, your time in learning the new applications, your time in getting accustomed to it is by no means free. So we can see a lot of what economists like to call stickiness in that situation. That is, we might all agree that maybe an open source environment, both for content and software, would be good, but at the same time, there is that stickiness. I think one of the more interesting pieces of this actually has to do, and this sort of segues into the next piece of this module, a lot of it has to do with what might happen in Bangalore. I remember, must have been about 5 years ago, Bill Gates went to India. Did I tell this story before? Bill Gates went to India, it was circa 2001, 2002, when Indian outsourcing, software outsourcing was getting very big and hitting a lot of the headlines, and there was a lot of talk, is all of our coding going to move to India, et cetera. And what Microsoft had noticed was that actually, if you're a programmer in India, an open source project is frankly very, very good stuff to work on. Why? Because you don't have to be a Microsoft employee. You can develop knowledge. You can develop a knowledge community around open source software. You can have nice arrangements with local governments and other kinds of organizational entities. And in essence, basically, open source software offers a development of knowledge vector for a lot of programmers in India. It's open so that they can learn, they can share, etc., and they can, without any real large barriers, become world-class programmers using Linux code, which they can't do with a closed code either on the Mac side or on the Windows side. So it's interesting that Microsoft began to recognize that this was a real threat. And so Bill Gates went to Bangalore and went to Chennai and held these great big public meetings and invited all of the IT people, and he expected them to go, oh yes, great white sahib from America, we will do what you want, we will buy and be loyal to your Microsoft stuff. I mean, it was really incredibly imperial and I think more than a little bit racist. And interestingly, what happened was he did this as a big sort of sales push to try and lure a lot of the Indian programming community away from open source and toward Microsoft. And, you know, we tried to schmooze with them. But in fact, from what I read, his performance was actually so objectionable to a lot of the locals that it actually backfired. And a number of the programmers in the Bangalore area said, we don't want anything to do with these people. We would much rather do open source. And indeed, we can develop a knowledge community here that's world class, which we can't do if we're dependent on Microsoft software. So a lot of the future, I think, with open source, both software and content, really depends on how people mobilize, how people understand their role in building this new set of economic structures, business structures. So, any questions on that? Okay, the second part of this, and I'm obviously way behind, is about info and business and in the world at large. This is sort of a discussion of what we used to call the new economy, back 7 or 8 years ago, the notion that, well, who wants stuff, you know, who wants cars, who wants manufacturing stuff, that's so boring, it's so old, it's so 20th century, you know, we got to do the 21st century stuff, and that's all information and knowledge. And there was this very simplistic distinction made between old economy, new economy, and that the new economy is globalized and the old economy was based on local communities, that the center of the auto industry was Detroit and the center of the furniture industry was High Point, North Carolina. Now cars are made everywhere, cars can be designed anywhere, parts can be made anywhere, and we're now in this totally globalized world. Well, let's look at this notion of globalization. This claim that there's a major economic revolution of globalization going on. There have been essentially historically, and I won't belabor this, three major quote-unquote economic revolutions in the North Atlantic Basin. Again, I can't speak that much about China and South Asia, or Africa for that matter. But the first step, of course, was the commercial revolution. This was the recognition for example, there were a lot of indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere who had a lot of gold that, given enough guns and poison blankets and diseases, the white folks could go in and kill huge numbers of the people of color and steal their gold. Second step was they tried to put the indigenous people, the Native Americans, into the mines to dig the silver, to dig the gold. They tried to put them on the plantations to get them to do that. And lo and behold, for reasons I won't go into, it was virtually impossible to get Native Americans, Native indigenous people of the Western Hemisphere to do that. By the way, there's an interesting story, parallel story. Shooting forward a few hundred years, think of Southern Africa in the late 19th century. Southern Africa was, the interior of Africa was only started getting penetrated after about 1860. By about 1880, 1890, in what's called the Witwatersrand of South Africa, of what's today South Africa, the region around Johannesburg and Pretoria, and then north of there, white entrepreneurs started finding lots of gold and diamonds. And unfortunately, the gold and diamonds were buried in the ground. And so they said, okay, they went out and they needed people to dig the gold and diamonds, right? And so they went around to the local Africans and they said, hey, we'll give you these little pieces of paper. If you go down into that hole where it's 85 degrees and there's no air, we'll give you these little pieces of paper. And the Africans said, thank you, you can keep your little pieces of paper. We'd rather not work in those mines. And so as a consequence, what the Brits did was that they simply said, okay, we are now sovereign and we will put a tax on your land. And if you don't pay the taxes on your land, you'll lose your land and you will become landless and you can no longer keep on keeping on what you've been doing for the past 1,000 years. And so how do you pay your taxes on your land? With these little pieces of paper. And so if you want to keep your land, you'll go down into that hole and we'll give you these little pieces of paper that will allow you to keep your land. It was a form of political blackmail. Frankly, far more sophisticated than the way, of course, that a labor force was mobilized for the Western Hemisphere. Obviously, that was all about slavery. Now, my point here in talking about the commercial revolution is to recognize that certainly by about 1650, the price of slaves on the West African coast would vary according to the price of rum and sugar in London. Think about that for a minute. What it essentially meant, slaves are obviously the labor input for producing sugar, and sugar is the input for producing rum, obviously. You already have a very fairly efficient price translation system that says, okay, if the price of sugar goes up in London, the price of slaves on the Gold Coast of Africa has just gone up considerably. My point here is that you're already seeing prices get translated across oceans and across large distances. Indeed, there's been some research recently that indicates that economic conditions in Rome in the second, third, and fourth centuries would determine the price of spices in India, because the spices moved across Asia in that trade. My point here then is that when we look at the triangular trade of slaves, sugar, rum, etc., and later cotton, what we see is actually a very, very efficient, yeah, I know, we're not supposed to say that slavery was efficient. We're supposed to believe that it was this terribly oppressive system. Indeed, it was highly profitable. It was highly efficient, at least within the economic standards of the day. And the prices got translated very, very rapidly across the globe. Now, the next step of that was obviously bringing machinery into the equation, steam engines, looms, spinning machines, all of that sort of thing, the famous cotton gin, which obviously turned cotton from being a luxury fabric in the 1780s into a cheap commodity fabric in the by 1800. And what this meant was that we're told, if we think about the Industrial Revolution, if we look at the classic histories of it, it sounds an awful lot like the Information Revolution in its most ridiculous portrayals. That is, that the Industrial Revolution happened because the British, those plucky, inventive British, somehow invented all these cool machines, raised efficiency, raised productivity, raised output, and that put the globe on the path to prosperity that we have today. Well, in fact, if we look at what happened in the Industrial Revolution, we see that the bulk of the labor, the bulk of the efficiency that went into it, came from the slaves working in the Caribbean, working in the American South. If you look at, for example, the heroic British in their Industrial Revolution, how did the British factory workers survive? How did those 15-year-old girls working in those factories survive? Well, number one, what was the feedstock for the textile mills? It was cotton picked by slaves in the American South. What did the factory workers live on, or what did they use for energy, but sugar that came from the Caribbean? What did they do when they needed leisure time, which they had very little, but drink the rum made from the sugar in the Caribbean? When they needed a stimulant, what did they do? They drank the tea that the British Empire was growing on the island of Ceylon, now the country of Sri Lanka. What did they do when they needed childcare? They mixed some of that rum with some of the opium from the northern Indian region into a substance called laudanum, a mixture of alcohol and opium, and they gave it to their children. This is one of the reasons why the birth rates of British kids during the Industrial Revolution were so low. Their mothers were junkies or opium addicts quite often, and the children themselves started life as opium addicts. Opium that came, of course, from the labor of people in India, people in China. Cotton that came from the labor of slaves. My point is here that when we think about industrial revolutions, we should think of them as always being global. Globalization is not the slightest bit new. The next phase of it, of course, was the major shift that happened in the late 19th century, as historians generally don't talk about it in intro history courses, called the Second Industrial Revolution. This is where the mechanics got replaced by engineers, that manufacturing, that production, the new machinery of the 19th century, was less and less invented by plucky mechanics and more invented and developed and deployed and managed by university or technical school trained engineers. Now, how did this work? First and foremost, it worked on an international regime of patents. One of the major two of the major sets of patents were German. One set were the German chemical patents for aniline dyes, owned by Bayer Company, Bayer that also just happened to invent aspirin, a very, very lucrative product. It's actually a coal derivative. And the other side was electrical equipment, developed obviously in this country by Edison and Westinghouse, and in Europe by Siemens. But if you look at the contents of most of the goods manufactured, the resource base came from the entire planet. Where did the copper come from? The copper came from northern Chile, came from southern Congo, came from Arizona, came from literally only about five locations in the world. Where did the other kinds of metals other than iron come from? From mines stuck all over the planet, from Manchuria to Canada. All over the globe, from Manchuria to Canada. Basically, it was a knowledge-based industry, but it was a knowledge-based industry already from its birth with a global base to it. So my point here is that globalization is not new. What we see in the globalization today, frankly, is only a change in degree, not in kind. And indeed, we're told that, okay, everybody's so efficient now, you know, we have very good inventory management, we can figure out how to get the right goods to the right places. But then again, efficiency goes way back. What better way to move the labor force one needs from Africa to the Caribbean than to put them in 18 by 18 inch, 5 to 6 foot long, essentially casket-like spaces and ship them across the ocean. Indeed, we can begin to see, in essence, the industrialization of human labor on the plantation, the old story of plantations as being somehow traditional and backward. No, they were not. Plantations were the leading edge of industrial capitalism. So when we start thinking then of different phases of economic change, we have to recognize that just as slavery was an integral part of the Industrial Revolution, so also is advanced industry, metal bashing, as it were, what we do here in Michigan. Metal bashing is just as much an integral part of the new information economy as slavery was of the industrial economy. The major shift that happened in the 20th century and what really gave us the economic model that we're moving out of today is what we call the mass production, mass consumption model. Arguably, the beginning of it was not Henry Ford. We're always taught the moving assembly line at the Highland Park plant, 1911, I think it is, with a Model T. That gave us mass production, and that's what gave us, you know, the huge numbers of identical B-29 bombers that won the Second World War and fought the great battle against totalitarianism and racism. Oh, no, it didn't fight that battle. Sorry. But it did win that war, yes. But how was that done? It was done basically with a conversion of a knowledge base. The mass production economy of the 20th century was based on engineering. And the engineers came from schools just like this one, frankly, University of Michigan, Purdue, Wisconsin, basically generated thousands upon thousands of engineers who made that happen. But what was it about? It was, again, about creating the modal product for the massively generic population. Remember, the U.S. in 1920 was a country that was very, very diverse culturally. A large chunk of the population in the North was not born in the U.S. Many of them didn't speak English. A large population in the North that was born in the U.S. was born in the American South and migrated north in the years after the First World War with the first great migration of African Americans north. What this meant was that the mass market in the U.S. had a very, very powerful culturally integrating effect. Every American could buy, whether they were Italian-American, African-American, Yiddish-American, they could buy exactly the same bar of ivory soap. They could buy exactly the same Ford. They could shop at exactly the same Sears store. And indeed, it was an incredibly efficient model. Huge runs of identical products could be produced at blazing, blazing speed. And if you think about the Second World War, the Second World War was the pinnacle of that. The Americans were able, and it's a very interesting model that I'll just mention in passing. There were two different approaches to building the hardware for the Second World War. The Nazis, as part of their bizarre ideology, believed that basically mass production work, the repetitive work of the same gesture for 8 hours a day, the Nazis believed, and you know, I admit they were right, they believed that that degraded the human spirit. And mass production work was fine for lower races, Jews, Africans, Poles, etc., but that good Germans would not be degraded by repetitive industrial work. Instead, they moved toward a model, and when you think of this in terms of design, it's interesting. What they said was, okay, we will build extreme high-quality weapons, and we will do it with extremely skilled labor. So what they did was they took that sort of boutique approach to weapons building. That is, we'll make very high-quality weapons, put a lot, and they'll be very, very accurate. They'll be absolutely at the bleeding edge of technology. But we won't produce that many of them because, look, it's skilled labor that are building these in a craft